Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this evening's installment in the series of Jewish art, symbolism, and idolatry. So we're going to start exploring what exactly did the Luchot look like. So many people may be familiar with the way the Luchot look from the way they may have seen it in the Bayit or elsewhere in Shul. But the question that I'd like to explore tonight is that really what the Luchot looked like. So as you see here, the picture that we have here with the nice English one, so that is definitely not how the Luchot looked. So, but let's move on and let's see some examples of what they look like. Okay, so we're going to be looking for a couple of different things. When we look at the sources, we're going to be looking for the shape of the Luchot, their size, color, what exactly was written on the Luchot, as well as what material was Luchot made out of. If there's any other questions about Luchot that I don't end up covering, feel free to ask them. I'll hopefully have an answer, and if not, I'll hopefully be able to point you in some direction of where to find it. So here we go. So this is one. So here are some famous depictions that people may have seen. So here, this is an example of Rembrandt, where you see Moshe holding the Luchot. So as you can tell, well, they're in Hebrew, which is a step in the right direction. And you also note that they are curved on top. So we'll discuss whether or not we like that part or not. Okay. So next, I hope everybody here has seen the movie The Ten Commandments, because it's an excellent movie. So at the very end of the movie, and which if you manage to stay up for the first 3 hours and 25 minutes, you'll see the scene, right, of where he receives the tablets. So again, this is another depiction of what the Luchot may have looked like. Okay, we'll have a vote before we go about, after I show a couple pictures, we'll have a vote on which one everybody thinks is most likely. Okay? So, okay, now here we have the front page of the book of a sefer called Shnei Luchot HaBrit with there aren't Luchot here, but again, we have some nice square looking Luchot, which of course we edited out the actual Luchot to put it with this nice, to put the nice title of the sefer. Okay, again, this is from Amsterdam in 1698. Okay. And then here's modern artist depiction. I apologize for not having the entirely proper sourcing because I found this one on Wikipedia. But here's another option for what the Luchot looked like. So of all the ones that we have seen so far, which one do we like the best? Feel free to shout it out, or if you're just
Aesthetically, I like the curve. I know that Chabad are adamant that they're cubes.
Right. So we're going to find out soon that it's not just Chabad, and we're going to figure out why. And then we'll also see that it's not necessarily entirely so clear that even that's good, that either side is right or wrong. And we will see. Because very rarely we get this argument that lasts so long would it actually be quite so simple. I see. Oh. All right, so now let's dig in. So first important thing to note is that there are many psukim describing the Luchot, so we're going to go with two. So one of them is, and these are both from various points in Matan Torah, where we see God the Torah describing what the Luchot looked like. So I'm going to read the Hebrew and then the English, because some of the drashot we have later are based on these psukim, meaning when the Chazal are going and the various midrashim are going to be trying to figure out what they look like, they're going to be analyzing the psukim not only in Hebrew, not only for the content, but also some of the particular phraseology. Okay, so the first one we have comes from Perek Lamed Aleph, which is the Haluchot Masnei Elohim Hema, HaMichtav Michtav Elohim Hu, Charut al Haluchot. So this so when God finished speaking to him at Sinai, so he gave. So God gave to Moshe Luchot. The Luchot were made by. Wait, are these in the? The translations are in reverse of the Hebrew. That's confusing. My apologies there. I was trying to figure out why I was translating and it didn't line up. Okay. My apologies for that being out of order. So when he finished speaking with him on Mount Sinai, God gave Moshe the two Luchot HaBrit, right? The two tablets of the covenant. And they were stone tablets inscribed with the finger of God. So we'll have to figure out what exactly does it mean by the finger of God. Okay, and also what does it mean by inscribed is also going to be a very relevant point we're going to discuss later as well. Then continuing on, when it says that the tablets were God's work and the writing was God's writing incised upon the tablets, the question is, what does that mean? All right, we have these miraculous tablets written by God. Right, so again, these are the originals. So what does that mean, and what does that look like? So the Psukim themselves are unfortunately not entirely clear, so we're going to have to look more towards the other sources in our tradition to hopefully try and narrow it down a little bit. Okay, so as far as the shape of the Luchot, so in terms of you know, the degree of the controversy, so everybody here, I hope, has heard of the chief rabbinate of Israel. So I'd like to point out a little bit of the development of their symbol. So here we go. So there's two sides. So there's two symbols here. Okay, one left is the original one that the Ramun HaRashit in Israel had from their founding in the early 1900s, and the one that Rav Kook decided was the right one. And then on the right, you have the one that they decided to change 6 years ago. So which one do we like better? What do we think?
Zay, I think it's actually, as Mark said, aesthetically, the one on the left is better.
Yes, aesthetically, the one on the left is better. Right, so see, is there anything more than just aesthetics to why you'd think the one on the left might be right? So here we go. So the source for the grounding is actually
Can you hear me? Yeah, I was just gonna ask you, sorry, I came on late, but as to what we discussed last class, wouldn't the fact that Rav Kook said the left one was correct, we should follow practice? And the people who preceded us are usually more holy or more correct.
Right. So this is an instance where we have where there's been an ongoing debate for several centuries. Sorry, millennia. Use the wrong word there, right? So this is a case where they're both traditions were extant. So it's not that either of them are necessarily wrong. Putting in, you know, sculptures in synagogues, that's a question that might run over into you're actually in violation of something. But as far as if you happen to not have the most accurate depiction of a historical scene or of, you know, let's say again, assuming you're not trying to, because we can't make Luchot anymore, so whether or not I make my drawing of it correct or not will not affect whether or not it won't be halakhically problematic or religiously problematic in any way. But let's say the argument over, let's say the way the menorah looks is a much bigger deal because it's important because the Chon HaMikdash constructed a menorah that they hope to use when the Beit HaMikdash is speedily rebuilt in our days. So for that, which opinion you go by makes a really big difference. But as far as for the Luchot, so we'll find out when we rediscover where the Aron was hidden away, we'll hopefully find the Luchot and we'll know the right answer. But until then, it's fun to try and figure out which one it is. So the next one point. So now, as far as for the people, again, we're arguing about the rounding. So the main source of the rounding is this source in the Zohar. So again, we're not going to discuss, you know, when the Zohar is written and that. That's a whole different shear. That'll take that'll take a while. But here's a source that seemingly is definitely is the oldest source we have, written source, as opposed to we have found round the top ones that, you know, going back all the way for around 1,000 years, both in Jewish depictions as well as in Christian depictions. So, but here's the only written source that we have to support that supports the rounding. Every other source that says they're rounded is basically quoting based on the Zohar. So let's go through it in the English, and then hopefully we'll try and see what we think that this would lend itself towards actually having the shape of the luchot with the rounded top. Somebody like to read the Zohar on the left, then the English translation.
Okay, what were the luchot made of? We were taught that it was from the dew above that flowed down from ancient holy times. When it flowed to the holy orchards, Gan Eden, God took two cups of it, and they solidified, froze, and became two precious stones. God breathed on them, and they became the two luchot.
Okay, so based on that description, what if you have basically you've got molten stone, which is also being used as nourishment for Gan Eden. So that then crystallizes and forms into becoming the luchot. So what shape would you expect that to look like? Would they make it rounded or still square? What do we think?
Round.
Right? So Mitzi says round. Anybody think it would still make it more or less square?
Depends on the shape of the cup it was poured into.
Correct, right? The question is, how did it pour in? Was it, you know, was it a vertical and then it kind of like bubbled a little bit on top? It could also affect the angle of the curve that you want on top also, because it can't be like a true, like, again, depending on the viscosity and the adhesion and cohesion properties of the fluid would affect, you know, the rate of the curve, etc. But it's possible, but based on that source, right, maybe you could read it as being rounded on top, but you also simply say, well, maybe just, you know, filled in the whole mold and then that was it. So you could read it both ways, this source. But now we're going to look at some sources that don't necessarily seem to align so well. Okay, so now here is the question of the size of the luchot, which is going to be relevant to the shape as well. Okay, so this comes up. There's a debate between the Gemara in Bava Batra and the Gemara in Shkalim about the exact size of the luchot. So here we have the version in Bava Batra, which says that as the tablets, their length was six, their width was six, and their thickness was three hand breadths. Depending on your, ever hear more familiar with metric or inches, what's better? What do we think? You prefer here, the conversion on the bottom is over here, right? So between 8 to 10 inches is the, 8 to 10 centimeters, or between, you know, 3 and 4 inches is the size of a hand breadth, a tefach. So that would mean that it's, you know, a little good centimeter, let's make it a little bit easier. So it's six, so it's around, you know, 60 by 60. And then, you know, then 30 deep centimeters, right? Okay, right? Decently sized, not huge, but also note that what the description that we're using here, it's in three dimensions, right? And generally, when you simply have three dimensions to describe something, what are you describing? A cube or a rectangular prism of some sort, right? Generally, if you wanted to say something is, you know, rounded, you'd have to say it's simply listed as is. You assume you're referring to a square cubic structure, unless otherwise mentioned. But there's another possibility for its. My transition there is off. Sorry. The length of each one of the tablets was six hand breadths, and their width was three hand breadths. So this would mean that, you know, the only problem is that you don't have a third dimension for the depiction in the Talmud Yerushalmi. So you're not entirely sure how thick it was or whether or not the width meant the thickness, but according to the first description, you've got a very thick, squarish looking lucha, as opposed to according to the Talmud Yerushalmi, where it would look more like roughly the standard lucha that you see nowadays with those approximate proportions of it being rectangular as opposed to being square, right? So according to the Talmud Bavli, they were square, but according to Talmud Yerushalmi, they're rectangular. Okay, so that's a pretty big difference that we already have, right? Okay, square or rectangular, in addition to the question of whether or not they're rounded on top or not. You'll see a lot of these aren't, various commentators have taken their stances. But as far as we have a dispute between the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli. So both, we'll see a lot of the parts of it is just simply left as a dispute with often not being resolved. Not that some people decide to take a stance on which one they think is right, but the Gemaras seemingly just are arguing with each other. Okay? Clear?
Sorry, I came late, but was there an earlier source than the Zohar that said it was rounded?
No.
Or is that the earliest source?
That's the earliest written source. We have depictions from earlier. The Zohar's dating itself is up for debate. It ranges from either it was written in the by Rosh Hashanah Baruch Hai, meaning in the 2nd century CE, or it was actually tradition, some of which may have been from Rosh Hashanah Baruch Hai, but it's actually only written down in the by Moses de Leon in the
1200s.
Right.
Yeah, so I was going to say that according to the people who said that Moshe de Leon wrote the Zohar in the 1200s, it would be pretty hard to believe that someone in the 1200s just make up the rounded without a prior source. It's kind of...
Right, so he's not... So it's possible, but again, it's also like not beyond reason, right? So the question is, where would he have drawn it from? And it just could be the other tradition, but it doesn't have to be a tradition that the Gemara... that the Talmud Bavli or the Talmud Yerushalmi thought was likely, as we'll see. Yet it's still a possibility, but it's just simply not one of the more mainstream ones. Also, again, both of these Gemaras are taken from where they're trying to describe how they would be able to fit the Luchot inside of the Aron, and they're assuming that there's the assumptions of the measurements there all assume that it's clearly square and cubed we're dealing with. Certain things were rounded, let's say, the Torah scroll, where they expressly talk about, they mention pi in the rounding. But in a case where they don't, you'd have to assume that if they're trying to maximize the space of the Aron to fit all of the important items inside of it, they would have mentioned that if it was rounded and it was a half circle on top. Because that would save them some space to fit other things inside of the Aron. Clear?
Yeah.
Okay. So as far as the another example of where it might have been rounded, so here again, this is not a Jewish source. This is the Mesha inscription, again originally written in Moabite, which is a close cousin of Hebrew, part of the Semitic family languages. Again, this was written 3,000 years ago. So again, so later than the Torah, but as you'll see here, this was a nice big basalt stone. Also, the dimensions are also somewhat similar to that of the Luchot, in that it's 100 a meter tall, 60 by 60. And you'll know that the top of it is rounded. So there definitely was a concept of when you make, going back several thousand years, of there being stone inscriptions, not something being square, but of deliberately making them rounded on top. So there definitely was. So this is a physical testimony to that reality of people making things with rounded tops. Doesn't necessarily tell us anything about whether or not the Luchot were or not, but it definitely does show a possibility of what. As you'll see, we saw some of the depictions of the Luchot earlier, that this shape definitely does look like some of the depictions of Luchot that we've seen.
So, are we saying that Moshe built these Luchot?
We're going to get, yes, our current version of the Luchot were made by Moshe. Which we'll get there in just a bit about how and what he made them out of.
So you're saying according to this opinion, this view, you're saying that this was common to do rounded.
As far as the tradition of, oh, they're rounded on top. So some say that, oh, they simply copied it, like the Christians made it up or whatnot. So that there was a style of doing it for thousands of years. So again, was that the style which God chose when he made, who copied whom? We'll see. Most of the sources indicate that they were square, cubish, right, or rectangular. But historically, there definitely was, there were, you know, stone tablets made that were rounded on top. So both of those are distinct possibilities. Okay. I'm also just, I think you can hear some background noise, so we can just, mute unless you're currently.
There's one person who hasn't muted themselves. I don't know if you can mute them.
I'll mute them. I'll mute everybody, and then that should solve the issue. Just feel free to unmute whenever you have anything to add. Don't worry. Okay. And I think that's everybody. I got it. There we go. Okay. Again, please feel free to unmute whenever you have any questions. Don't want to miss any of that. Okay. So the point being is that, there was the tradition of it being not necessarily Jewish tradition, but people were making rounded top stone structures with text on it. So was that the Luchot? Maybe not, but it's a possibility. So, and now as far as the best source for them being cubish, so right, you know, cube rectangular overall. So I'd like to point us to the continuation of the Talmud Yerushalmi in Shkalim, which will also inform us about how many of the Luchot were on each of the tablets, which will also definitely affect whether everybody views the Luchot. Somebody like to read? Start on the left from Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, but how were the tablets written?
How are the tablets written? Rabbi Chanan ben Gamliel says, five on this tablet and five on that tablet. This as it is written. And he wrote them upon the two tablets of stone. That is, five of the Ten Commandments on this tablet and five on that tablet. But the rabbis say, all of the Ten Commandments were written on this tablet and all the same ten were written on that tablet. This is as it is written, and he declared unto his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even the 10 words. This teaches that there were 10 on this tablet and 10 on that tablet. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai says, 20 on this tablet and 20 on that tablet, as it is written, and he wrote them upon two tablets of stone. This teaches that there were 20 on this tablet and 20 on that tablet. Rabbi Simai said, 40 on this tablet and 40 on that tablet, as it is written, on the one side and on the other were they written as a cube, tatroga. This sounds like in the Haggadah, how many makot were there?
Right. But has anybody ever seen a depiction of the Luchot where there were 10 on each of the Luchot? Has anybody ever seen that? No, we've never seen that. But that's the opinion of the Chachamim, meaning the majority opinion. At the time of the Talmud Yerushalmi at the time of the Tanaim, that was the majority opinion. Okay, 10 on each. All 10 on each. And then there's the Rav Chanan ben Gamliel, he's the opinion that we recognize. And then Rav Shimon bar Yochai has it being 20 on each, which means that on each side, well, depending on I will see about how exactly the Luchot were described. So if you simply say they're etched in a little bit, that would mean that there's 10 on opposite faces. We'll see later about how they're etched all the way through, which would mean that you'd have to, it would be very complicated to figure out, but you'd somehow manage to get going from one side through the other side in two different planes without crossing over each other. And as far as if you're talking about, making things complicated, so trying to do that with 40, which would mean that each side of the cube-shaped tablets. So again, the one that's definitely incompatible with the narrow perspective, that according to Samayev, having a 40 and 40, it only really makes sense if they were basically cubes. If they were, even if they're half a cube, I guess you could try to say maybe on one side they're written smaller, but it would not work according to, let's say, the opinion of the Yerushalmi we saw earlier of it simply giving a width and a height and not giving a breadth, because you clearly need quite a bit of breadth in order to fit all the luchot on one side. And if you wanted to have it go through, I'm not sure how you'd manage to pull that off without breaking the laws of physics in many ways, because you can't go, if you etch straight through, yet it comes out the other side looking forwards. I'm just very confused as to how physically that works. But again, since luchot were miraculously made by God and then recreated again by Moshe, it's entirely possible that that is what it was. Just, I simply don't physically understand how to recreate that.
Are you going to talk about which 10? You know, Yitro, Bet Hanan, Shamor, V'Zachor.
Oh, I was not planning on talking about that. Which 10? But that is an excellent question, yes. Yeah, so I did not look that part up, to be perfectly honest. That is a good question. As in, how would that have worked when there are differences between the first luchot and the first time in Shemot and the second time in Dvarim? They are different. So the question is, how would that have been written? Like when it says Zachor Shamor, how by Shabbos? So how do you write both? Good question. Something else that I'd also be very fascinated to see, was it like Schrodinger's cat? When you look at it from one angle, it's one. From another angle, it's another one. Again, all these are way beyond. Again, I do have a degree in physics and mathematics, but I do not. It's a little more on the mystical side, and I'm not quite sure how that would have played out in the physical plane. Okay, but so currently we see that what we consider to be the majority opinion of how many luchot there were, in fact, seemingly is the minority opinion. Okay? And now the next... there we go. Okay. The next question is, what exactly was written? So Mark actually pointed out, well, what about Shamor V'Zachor? Well, if you think that's complicated, here's another doozy. Hananiah, the nephew of Rabbi Yeshua, says, between each and every statement that was written on the tablets, its precise details and the explanation of its letters were written as well, as is written, filled with beryl. Imulaim betarshish. So, and Tarshish is the name of a sea, or more likely, an area of the Mediterranean. The verse is indicating the Torah is filled with all these details, like the Great Sea is filled with waves. And this is a continuation of the previous Gemara. So saying, not only are we saying maybe there are 40 luchot, 40 times where each of the commandments written, right? So you get four full sets, but also that in between each of the words of the Sefer Devarim, we have the rest of the Torah inside. So,
yeah, isn't it possible that a lot of these, some of these sources you're bringing, like this one, shouldn't be taken literally? It's more metaphorically, or
yes. You know, so this one, right? So this one in particular is very easy to say that this is simply referring to the fact that the Sefer Devarim are general rules, of which the rest of the Torah can be subsumed within. Because it does seem to be slightly impossible to have fit all that onto the luchot, and because it just doesn't make physical sense. And it wouldn't really necessarily be legible either. It wouldn't work in the physical plane for that to have been the case. So some opinions would say that the original luchot were done in such a fashion with everything on them, but then when Moshe broke them, and then reform them, then that element was lost. Meaning that, and when they say that all the details, it's referring to all Torah Shebaal Peh, was also written down, meaning the oral Torah had been written down as well initially on the first set of the Luchot, and then in the end, they were not. So, and then, again, then as far as to explain how this could work, so Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish compares it to Just as between one large wave, another large wave, there are smaller waves in the sea, so too the precise details and explanation of the letters of the Torah are written between each and every commandment. So again, how does this physically work out where you have the encapsulated details within the larger main commandments and that being physically depicted? It's a good question. So again, so this one is one that you can very easily say is simply meant to be more metaphorically than literal, but they seemingly are talking about it literally. And we still have the issue that there were four different opinions for how exactly, how many luchot, how many of the dibrot were on each luchot, which luach, luach. Okay, so don't worry. At the end of this, I will not have a conclusion. Not to worry. So now the next, another question that is relevant is what were the luchot made out of? So the initial luchot were made, you know, God made them. So we have the Zohar indicating that God had solidified or crystallized them out of some molten fluid. But we also have another source for what they were made out of. So when Moshe is told by God to remake the luchot after he shattered them, so God said to Moshe, carve two tablets of stone like the first, and I will inscribe upon the tablets the words that were on the first tablets, which were shattered. So based on that English translation, taking from Sepharia, it kind of sounds like, well, that Moshe's job is to carve out the general shape of the luchot, and then God's going to write in the letters. Correct? Because it says that Moshe hews, but God is the one who writes. So it also is a question, you know, for the second set of luchot, was it made entirely by Moshe, or is it made by a combination? And when we look at Rashi, so Rashi explains of what, when Moshe is told to inscribe to hew the stones, what are they carved out of? So, translation also from Sepharia, that he showed him a quarry of sapphire in his tent and said to him, the chips shall be thine. And it was from there that Moshe became so rich. So Moshe carved it out of this, here, Sanpirion is the Hebrew. Sounds like the Livnat Sapir that was seen at Matan Torah by the Zakanim and the Jewish people. So but the question is, if we say Sanpirion, is that really mean, the English translation says sapphire, is that really what it is? So as far as is that really the case, so there's actually two options. One is the name that sounds like Sapphire the most, which is sapphire. But the question is that really the original rock? So this comes up a lot also in regards to discussing what exactly is the color of Tchelet. So on the right, we have something called a stone called lapis lazuli. So lapis lazuli is a semi-precious stone, not quite as hard as sapphire is. But if you know, there's these little goldish flecks scattered throughout the stone. So one of the descriptions that we have of the by Tchelet is that when you look at Tchelet, it'll remind you of the sea, which will remind you of the sky, which will remind you of God's seat of glory, the Kisei HaKavod. So the question is, how would it do it in that order? So one of the explanations is that it's made, again, this is more, again, this is not quite an explanation that is as popular amongst the Jewish sources, but more academic sources. They say that it's lapis lazuli because a lot of ancient depictions and precious stones, they deliberately use lapis lazuli, especially in Egypt, because it very much looked like the evening sky with gold, with the stars affixed inside of it, which works very well. You see that the bottom of God's throne looked like the heavens. So makes sense that heavens at night is when it looks, again, when the heaven, when you can see it the best, because in the day you're kind of blind by the sun. So it would make sense that you're comparing it to lapis lazuli. So again, so those are, so, but according to basically everybody, the luchot were definitely, the color was most definitely blue, right? The exact shade of blue, you can argue, was it the, you know, one on the right, one on the left, but at death, they were most definitely blue. Okay, again, so far so good. So another note on the which one it is that that's also relevant is their degree of strength. So so sapphire is the second strongest natural substance after diamond, as opposed to lapis lazuli, which is far lower down on the toughest scale. So as far as which one would have been easier for Moshe to break, so it would have been easier if Moshe had broken luchot made out of lapis lazuli. But of course, as anybody who may have run out of shattered a crystal at some point, no matter how strong a crystal is, in theory, they all do have a shatter point, especially if you end up hitting them in the right spot. So,
sorry, I'm not sure of that last point. Are you saying I know it has to be blue because remembering the sky and God and everything, but the purpose that it has to be strong is because Moshe ended up breaking it?
No, why you would want it to be a slightly weaker stone.
But why? It was given over as a Torah. It's like after the fact to say,
Correct. It's a non-essential factor. Moshe smashed them. Who cares how he smashed them? It doesn't matter. But some people are bothered by, it was too hard to smash sapphire. Like, human beings can't really smash sapphire. So maybe it was lapis lazuli instead. But the other hand, you're saying no, because if it's a crystal, you could have shattered, you hit the right spot anyways. So let it be with sapphire, because that sounds better. Okay. That looks better. It could be better. So it's one of those arguments where you could argue both sides. Neither side is really conclusive. And almost all of the sources the rabbinic sources tend to support the sapphire read as opposed to the lapis lazuli read. But again, you could make the argument for both.
That's because Rashi said it.
He just not said Sam Perion, which is sapphire. Yes.
Yeah.
That's sapphire in Greek. So, but again, if you're comparing it to Lifnat Sapir, the stone of Sapir, so that is debate if that's really what that meant in the context of in the Torah itself. So if you're comparing it to where God's the, again, how does that physically work out? And there's a separate question of God's physicality, also a very long debate, but I don't know if we'll have time to squeeze that in tonight. Yeah, I think we're already at 40 minutes, so I don't think so. Okay, so the next point I mentioned earlier about the floating letters, because when they say charut, when the luchot were called charut, right, inscribed by the hand of God, so the question is, so what does that mean? So in the Gemara Megillah, it says that Rav Chisda said that the letters Mem and Samech in the tablets of the covenant stood by way of a miracle. But since the way that the luchot were made was by, they were able to be seen all the way through, right, carved straight on through, so therefore that meant that the Mem or the Samech, as you see on the right, you see the letters Mem and Samech, they have them. Right, you see the block script here. Now the mem is fully enclosed, so the middle section would have to be floating in midair. And similarly for Samech, it would have to be floating in midair as well. Okay, so as we mentioned before, that would work for some of the argument we had earlier about how many of the commandments were on each. So that would be a problem according to the opinion that say that it's on each facet of the luchot, because I don't know how you manage to pull off multiple different floating letters in different directions without running into each other at all when the luchot themselves aren't that large, and it would be hard to, again, now that's not impossible, but it would lead to some physically physics bending issues, just all the way through, yet red from all four sides, yet cards are floating. I'm just very confused. Again, you could try and say some advanced form of Klein bottle type structure, but at a certain point, I'm not sure you would wind up with being basically physically impossible to exist.
Saying they used our current font and not the Charlton Heston font?
That's the next source. This is under the assumption that they used the... Well, what is a Charlton Heston font? We're going to get to that in just a second. Okay, so first let's read the Yerushalmi, which has that exact argument. Okay. So here we go. This is a Talmud Yerushalmi Megillah paralleling the Gemara in Talmud Bavli Megillah we just read. So here Rabbi Levi says that those who say the Torah was written in Ketav Ivri, here it says Ra'atz, meaning scratched. So that would mean that the Ayin said miraculously. According to the opinion that the Torah is given in Ketav Ashuri, that would mean that the Sama said miraculously. Okay? So now as far as what exactly do we mean by that? So let me explain a little bit about what are Ketav Ivri and Ketav Ashuri. So first we want to see about what their history is and what, actually let's go ahead a little bit and then we'll go back. Okay. So when we say Ketav Ashuri, we're referring to modern block print on top here. And when we say Ketav Ashuri, that's something called Paleo-Hebrew or ancient Hebrew script. Okay. This is the word Ivri, this is Ketav Ashuri is the top one, and then Ketav Ivri or Paleo Hebrew is the bottom one. They went through several different iterations historically, but we will leave that aside for now as to when exactly. But again, they're clearly two distinct forms of writing, but they both correspond to the same sounds. Also, I'm going to be placing in the chat again the sources. So again, a lot of the sources are hyperlinked. So if you want to click on through to see them, you will get to the original sources. And if anything is unclear, again, and you want the more exact source, please let me know and I'm happy to send you more. Also, if anybody happens to not be on my on the email list I send out with the recordings and the PowerPoints, please let me know and I will add you. Okay, so now let's go back to the previous source. The question is, what script? Okay, so what the question of what script the Torah was originally given in, as well as what script the Luchot originally given in. So there is I wrote like a 20-page paper on just this point, but we're gonna try and just summarize it quickly. Okay, so what script? So Marzutra or Mar Ukva said originally the Torah was given to Israel in Hebrew characters. And in the sacred, and the sacred Hebrew language, meaning in Ketav Ivri, right? Because Ketav Ivri literally translates to the Hebrew script, okay? Like Ivri. Okay. Later, in the times of Ezra, the Torah was given in the Ashuri script, and the Aramaic language, or of the Aramaic language. So it means that initially Torah was given to us in Ketav in the Paleo-Hebrew, and then in the time of Ezra, it became what we now consider to be Hebrew. So on that, and then finally they selected for Israel the Ashuri script and the Hebrew language, leaving the Hebrew characters and the Aramaic for the Hedyota. So, who are meant by the Hedyotot? Rav Chitza says the Kutians. And what is meant by the Hebrew characters? The Libunah script. Okay, so that is the original source. Let me just get a summarize it outside. So the question, so there's a couple of options for what the order is in terms of Torah being given, as well as Luchot being given. So Luchot either was given in one or the other. Right, either the Luchot were the either Ketav Ivri or Ketav Ashuri. So it has to be one or the other. So the Ritva actually says, no, the first one's written in Ketav Ashuri, the second's written in Ketav Ivri. But most other people would say it's one or the other. And if you tell me Yerushalmi leaves it as a it could be either. We don't know. Both depend on which opinion you hold up about what the Torah itself was given in. So one option is that the Torah was originally given in Davashuri, and then Ezra went came along, and when they came back from Babel and changed it via God's permission to be what we now call the Hebrew characters. Another opinion is that originally it was given in here. Let me just here. Originally given in here. So originally given in the block letters, then afterwards it was changed to Ktav Ivri, and then Ezra switched it back to Ktav Ashuri again. And there's another opinion in the Gemara, not here quoted elsewhere, that it was always being Ktav Ashuri. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, so those are the options for what script the Torah and Luke were given in, right? Either initially in Paleo-Hebrew, initially in Ktav Ashuri, or some combination thereof. Till we got to the to what we now call modern day Hebrew script for the Torah and everything else. As far as the Kutim continuing to write in the Paleo Hebrew, so that actually was the case. And in the Second Temple, we found in Qumran, they deliberately only would only write God's name in Paleo Hebrew, not in actual Hebrew. Seemingly that they were still maintaining the tradition that you're supposed to keep writing in Ktav Ivri, even though Chazal were saying, you know, the Rabbinites, that no, you should only be writing in Ktav Ashuri, because that's what Ezra said, and Ezra matters a lot. Ezra Sofer, Ezra the Scribe, this is one of the things that Ezra the Scribe did with God's approval, of course, was to change the letters.
I've heard some Divrei Torah focused on the shape of letters, the hey, it has a gap and things like that. So this would seem pretty significant. If we feel that the shape of letters have holy significance, it's a big deal.
Correct. So so I'm going to give you an idea. So the answer is that it isn't that, as I mentioned, there's a debate amongst the Tanaim, right, within Chazal of which one it was. A lot of those explanations are according to the opinion that it was either originally given in Ktav Ivri, then changed and changed back, block script to Paleo Hebrew and back, or always in block script. But what if it was the other way around? How could we save it? So one option is that one that I like the best is that of the Kedusha HaLevi, Rabbi Levi Miberdichev. Okay, so he wrote this. So again, he's a Hasidic Rebbe. One of his students asked him this, you know, how do you deal with this? So he has a very interesting drasha on Purim, where he explains that at Purim, the Jews accepted the mitzvah differently than they had prior. When the Jews were at Har Sinai, they accepted the mitzvah under duress, right? The God raised the mountain over the the mountain over them, harking yigi, right? Mountain was literally over their heads, so they had to say that they accepted the Torah. When did they finally accept it willingly? That was only the time of Esther, when it says kimu v'kiblu. They accepted what they had accepted already, meaning as opposed to before when they accepted the Torah, it was under duress. Now they're accepting it willingly. So, Relating Tradition continues saying that Ezra was worthy of giving the Lukot, if not, and the Torah, if not for the fact that Moshe had. So even though Ezra was not the one to give over the Torah and the Lukot, because in his time, right, meaning right after the time of Esther, the Jews finally willingly accepted all the Torah and the Mitzvot. So even though, correct, the Ktav may have been initially Paleo-Hebrew, but because the Jews finally have reached the perfection of accepting the Torah willingly, God decided that it was time to change the letters so they always should have been, and to change it to be Ktav Ashuri, what we now call block script. So yes, it could have a lot of ramifications for whether or not all the drasha you have on the shapes of the letters, but not to worry, it is still, you're still able to do drasha based on the letters. Just it's important to realize that it's entirely possible that it was originally given in Ketav Ashuri, and that, sorry, Ketav Imri, not just Ketav Ashuri, and that that's actually an opinion of some of the Tanaim and the Gemara. So both are possibilities. Neither of them are Kofrim or terrible people, just difference of opinions. As we saw throughout this whole discussion, there's a very wide range of what the Luchot as well as the letters of the Torah look like. Greg? Okay, so now just a brief summary of what we've covered. And if anybody has any questions that I missed, please let me know. Okay, so I see that it, just fill them in. So we saw that from the rabbinic sources, it seems that most likely that they were square, but we do have a long tradition dating back almost roughly a millennia of them being rounded as well. And also, there are other sources that people did used to make rounded stone structures going back thousands of years. So then it's not unheard of that they could have been rounded on top. As far as the stone they were made out of, so we discussed either sapphire or lapis lazuli. As far as the size, they're either 6x6x3 tefachim or 6x3 tefachim. Right, so that's the question whether or not they're really nice and thick or really thin. Again, whether or not the front is in the dimension that we think of it, or whether or not they are very much blocky when you looked at them from the front. We discussed the question of how many are in each. The question of whether or not just there are 10 commandments or the entirety of the Torah and all the details and the future details were inscribed upon it, as well as whether it was in the Luchot were written in Ketav Ashuri or Ketav Ivri, modern block print or paleo Hebrew. Okay, and also I want to remind everybody that we are going to be continuing next week on a regular scheduled Wednesday nights with we will be discussing cherubs and griffins. Anybody have any questions? Okay, well, thank you everybody for coming out.
And just to say mazal tov to you again.
Thank you. Yes. So thank you everybody for bearing with me with the test schedule. Thank God. First, went well. We named our son Yaakov Yosef, and I hope everybody has a happy Shavuot. And if somebody's has been arguing over what did the Luchot look like, you could tell them that you also don't have any idea.
It's a machloket.
It's a machloket. Correct.
Are you giving any other classes besides these?
At the moment, nothing else is scheduled. I will let you know if. Actually, I'm going to be giving one on Friday, the Baby Drash on Shemitah-related topics. I'll send you the details.
Is there a possibility you would give classes on Bible criticism?
There's a possibility, next year. I think I'm slotted out for, but yes, we can in the future. I'll have to run that by Rabbi Kropkin, then I'll let you know.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much.